Hello again, fellow listeners. Welcome to yet another episode of Geekcast, a show where we talk about everything new and old in technology and bring experiences and opinions rather than rules.
So just to set the context of this Twitter space for everyone, as the name says, what's new with the new Expo CLI? So we're going to talk about the SDK 46 of the Expo CLI. I think most of it was also covered in the AppJS Conf in the keynote where Evan spoke along with, I think, Charlie. And so I was just going through the blog post and it reminds me all the great things that Expo, Evan and team, they've done on this. So yeah, let's start. So where do you want to start, Evan? Like, what's new with Expo SDK 46?
Well, thank you for that introduction. Thanks again for having me. Like you said, I spoke about this pretty quickly at AppJS Conf. So if people haven't seen that video, I recommend checking it out because there's a couple of DevTools related announcements. The big thing with Expo SDK 46, well, there's a bunch of big things, but the big theme was really just pushing performance as much as we can. So we added like Flash List by the Shopify team, Skia, which is also sponsored by the Shopify team. And then we migrated to this new CLI as the default Expo CLI. So in the previous SDK, we had this version CLI kind of in beta. And for those of you who don't know, the way you used Expo was you would install this global CLI, which just had a ton of functionality inside of it. And now in SDK 46, there's a much, much smaller CLI, which you just install inside the Expo package. Then you can do like MPX Expo, Yarn Expo, and start the server. So it's a much simpler and easier setup.
Yeah, I'm yet to try it, but I think just doing MPX Expo start would actually do the job.
Yeah, so this is a pretty big change because in the past we had just a ton of functionality rolled into the global CLI. We had this build service, we had the submissions, so you could build everything in the cloud, submit host updates in the cloud. And because of this, we needed to kind of publish updates very frequently. And that's not great for a tool which is like associated with your project. So say you have maybe a project which is a few years old, and then you upgrade Expo CLI, you would have to like figure out which version to install to get that version of Expo CLI to work with your old version. It just leads to bloat and confusion over time. So moving to a local CLI is really nice, but it means you have to be pretty exact, and you can't ship a lot of errors.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So can I also run this in the existing projects? Like I can just go into any random Expo project, even the older ones, and run NPX Expo start, and it would figure out the version and all those things all by itself?
No, so there's a version of Expo CLI now installed in every project individually. So going forward, each project will just have its own copy. And this is really nice because it means that you can just have really old projects, really new projects, maybe you have a side project in your company project, and they will all work exactly as expected. Whereas the previous model, Expo Start worked the same way regardless of what version project you were using, which led to a lot of issues.
Yeah, I think it is very similar to how we solved Node versioning issue at one point, that, okay, add that as a dependency in the project, and it would pick that version of Node or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. I'm curious about like how we managed to make it lighter and faster as well, because the Expo CLI looks like the older one and the latest one, they have like 2x difference in terms of speed and size. How did that happen?
Yeah, so since there's a version installed in every project, you obviously don't want it to be very massive. So we needed it to be much smaller, but it also meant that in the previous CLI, we had things that supported every version of Expo, give or take. So we were able to just drop a ton of like bloat, which didn't apply to the latest version, which is also really nice because it means now we can just ship changes which would otherwise be breaking in the CLI because it will be shipped with that exact version. So one example of this is if people are familiar with like the pre-build command, We were doing something where we generate an index.js currently, and in the next version, we won't be doing that anymore. So that would be a breaking change. And in this new one, it's just like, it just works because everything is versioned as expected. So yeah, that was one way we made it smaller. The other way is that the majority of the CLI was cloud services. I believe I had like a slide in the presentation, which was just like three columns of text. And almost all of that was just various cloud services. And those require lots of network requests. Doing things like code signing required us to install Fastlane inside of the CLI, which meant we also needed to ship Ruby binaries, which meant that things didn't work very well on lots of different computers like Windows machines. So we were able to drop just all of that, tons and tons of code, and move all that over to EAS CLI, which is a global CLI, but it can update like on its own cadence, because it isn't really tied to any specific project. It's completely agnostic to the Expo project.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm curious about EAS now, because now EAS is a separate thing and the CLI is, both the things are like shipped separately. So does EAS run all those things on the local machine, or does it like send the package and the bundle to the cloud and then we publish everything and do and run everything on the cloud?
There's a bit of a mix. So obviously the building, the part that requires a Mac, happens on the cloud, so that people who are like Windows users can build with any machine. But some of the code signing, we actually re-implemented all that in Node, so you can just run that on any machine, but we don't need to ship Ruby binaries. So there's a bit of a mix. Like some, it's kind of, so the way that we do code signing, the way that Fastlane does code signing, and the way that everyone does Apple code signing automation works, is that we use this like unofficial Apple API along with the official API. But the official API doesn't provide everything. Like for instance, you can't create app entries, you can't set up things like merchant IDs, you can't link certain values. It's very like weird small things. And so wherever we can, we use the official API and we run that in the cloud. Wherever we can't, we use the cookies API and we run that locally, because my understanding is that the cookies are like, they're kind of marked with a geolocation so that they prevent this kind of cloud interaction. If we could, we would run all of it in the cloud, but due to certain fruit-based companies, we have to kind of mix and match.
Yeah, I understand that. And I also, like, I'm well aware of the mess. I wouldn't call it mess, but yeah.
It's a mess.
the logged-in services, right? And not being so open source. And that leads mm-hmm. to all these complications. I totally agree. Like last time when I was doing deployment of iOS, I remember like where we started, then we jumped into Fastlane and then did a lot of manual work on like manual steps as well, even to get Fastlane working. So yeah, building iOS bundles, I mean, it's a bit of a mess. I agree with that. But yeah, interesting how it is all packed in a nice API and we don't have to care about a lot of things when we are using the EAS service. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, EAS code signing is great. It's like one of the best parts, to be honest. We actually just updated it a few days ago as well to support all the new WWDC 2022 functionality. So it's like driver kit and on-demand install capable. So there's like some app clip entitlements. There's just like a bunch of new functionality, which it just automatically supports. So if we automatically detect those in your project, we will enable them, code sign them, so your project doesn't fail to build, which is very frustrating. It's just super smooth.
It's also interesting to see that EAS is now default and it works with React Native Barebone project as well, because I still talk to a lot of people and there's this myth in the community that, okay, EAS is for Expo, but it is not. So did you have experience with people talking about the same thing?
Yeah, and obviously that comes from the years of the classic build service just not working with React Native and being kind of its own little world. So we're actually working on a bunch of that rephrasing, and some of this new CLI project helps with that a lot, because the way that Expo used to work was there was like the managed workflow and the bare workflow, and these kind of lived like side by side. And you could run Expo Eject to move from one side to the other, but you couldn't ever go back. So the way Expo works now is the bare workflow, I'm doing like quotation fingers, is just kind of like the default. It's just a React Native app. And then everything that Expo provides just sits on top of that. And so at any time, you can peel back layers and drop down into React Native. And doing this means that all of our tooling needs to support just regular React Native or even lower level, like just native apps. So EAS CLI is pretty much just a full-blown native CI. Like we could make a couple modifications and get it to work with projects that don't even have React Native installed in them. And yeah, I mean, the way that this basically kind of boils down is that we are, like right now, actually, just right before this call, we were working on kind of updating some of the docs to remove a lot of mentions of the managed workflow. And we're kind of switching that to just talk more about like using the pre-build command. So like in the new CLI, there's no eject command. Eject is totally gone. And every project runs pre-build at some point. So either you're a project that has no native code in it, you run Expo pre-build, that generates the native code based on the configuration. And you can treat that totally generated. You can keep running pre-build, delete the iOS and Android directories. Think of it like node modules, but for the iOS and Android directories, it's pretty cool. That effectively turns into just a regular native project, which we can then just build. So we want to position everything as just being native and having like all these layers of automation on top of it, which you can opt into or opt out of.
Okay, makes sense. So the eject thing that used to happen before, like it was one way. Now we have Expo pre-build. So how is that? I didn't quite get it. Like, how is that different? Like, does it eject now, or does it like run a part of it in a separate environment, or how does that work, or how is it different than eject?
Yeah, so eject was a very quick script which would generate some native code, and then you were responsible for going into that native code and manually doing things like, if you had camera permissions, setting those camera permissions in the YumFuP list. And it also provided a project which wasn't quite a regular React Native project. And so you often hit a lot of these errors that were undocumented, tricky to use. And this often resulted in people just saying, like, don't use Expo at all because it's just too difficult. So pre-build is very different in the sense that it has this customization layer called config plugins, where library authors, if they have like a camera library or a Bluetooth library, can say, okay, this library requires the Bluetooth permissions be added to the YumFuP list in the Android manifest, and maybe it requires some Gradle properties be set. And then when you run pre-build, it goes through, it looks at all these config values, and then it generates the native code based on that. So it effectively works like a bundler, and you're able to just kind of stay using custom native code without ever actually having to write native code. So one of the biggest differences between pre-build and eject is that pre-build is continuous. You can just run it over and over again, whereas eject was like this one-time, one-way street, and then you no longer use any Expo tools.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. So I think in AppJS Conf I also saw that like now we can create like native files inside an Expo project, and that would get bundled. So is like pre-build the same thing? Like it takes all those files and injects it on the runtime and then deploys it for iOS and Android?
Yeah, so pre-build is, if you think about a library having these kind of configuration side effects, some libraries have native side effects as well. So for instance, maybe you have a notifications library and that requires you add values to the app delegate or the main activity. And for those, we have this mechanism in our Expo Native Modules API, sometimes called the Suite API, which has these kind of like hooks. So you can implement in your library something like application did finish launching with options, and then the root app delegate will propagate all those events up to each library which is subscribed to it. So you can safely implement, you know, something in, you know, whatever language you're using, and then it doesn't matter which language the root app delegate's using, it can always like respond to it.
So we have a number of ways to effectively keep your project really small and lean. And one of the coolest things about this is that it means you can have these really, really complicated native projects, which just perform really well at scale because you can easily upgrade, you can easily downgrade, you can easily add new libraries. And in your native project, you just have like an app delegate. You have like one native file and everything else is mitigated out to packages. So if you were to pre-build all those packages, then you can have this app which is thousands of native modules and it would just build in like seconds. So at scale, React Native could be this super, super powerful tool, like one of the most powerful ways to build an iOS app.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Yeah, I think the pre-build makes sense. Like we can like have those chunks ready and then just stitches on the go when we want to actually build things. So makes sense. But what, like, there must be some limitations when we are not ejecting because we don't really get a native iOS and native Android project structure, right? Like if we like have a native developer, for example, Android or iOS, and they want to start from the first file, like, and then they want to deep dive and then reach to that React Native layer. So all those things are like, are they hidden inside somewhere under the hood, or do we still get access to those low-level files if we want to?
Yeah, so the way pre-build effectively works, and we actually just created a really nice doc for it on the Expo docs, but the way you should think of pre-build is kind of like npm install. So if you're a JavaScript developer, you can always just hop in the node modules and just write JavaScript inside of them and keep customizing them if you want. Obviously, if you do this, you can't run npm install again safely without overwriting those changes. Or if you look at it the other way, you can erase those changes by just running npm install. But you do kind of lose out on the scale of it. Like with node modules, you can easily add just thousands of files to your project and scale that up really nicely. Whereas the code that you personally maintain, it's much harder to maintain and scale up. So with pre-build, you can just hop inside of the iOS and Android folders and just start writing native code as you would, which is, you know, totally supported. The project that we output just looks like a regular React Native app, because it is just a regular React Native app. But we do recommend kind of sticking to pre-build because there's just like a ton of things which it solves. We actually added a pitch and an anti-pitch. So like the main things that it solves that are really nice is if anyone's really used React Native, they know that one of the biggest complaints is the like upgrading is just super difficult, especially at scale, because you have all these packages which have all this extra code everywhere and you have to like go in manually upgrade everything. If you want to remove a library, you have to remember what all that extra code was and you have to go in and like remove it. If there was overlap, it just gets even more complicated. So often you end up with like this orphaned code. So pre-build aims to kind of solve all these issues by creating this super organized and structured system where you can add and remove and upgrade.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I also see the reason why it's like that when you want to mix a lot of native code and all these things and still want to have one single source of truth and easy way to track things and add dependencies. So makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And it even goes past just building the app. There's some config plugins, like for instance, the OneSignal config plugin, which adds extra code signing information. So when you add certain modules, they increase the complexity of code signing. Code signing is already very difficult. And if you're using tools like Fastlane or EAS to automate that, and then you have to add some extra customization, then you effectively need to learn about all that automation that was going on just to improve it. So unlike something like Fastlane, EAS and like config plugins kind of work together. So something like the OneSignal config plugin can say, okay, I'm adding like a notification service extension. So now EAS needs to code sign for a notification service extension. So by simply installing that library and adding the config plugin, all of the code signing is also taken care of at scale. And if you just remove it, now all the code signing is again taken care of and it knows to not code sign to add those extra features. This is the same thing with like if you were to install Apple Authentication or if you were to set up a merchant ID when you run EAS, it goes through, it looks at all those entitlements, and then it's able to intelligently enable or disable them. So code signing is something that works very well behind the scenes, and you almost never have to interact with it.
Interesting. Yeah, I can totally see the value in it, because and the way it is it integrates at different levels, like right from say code signing to maybe adding something to app delegate. So and those are the scary places for a JavaScript developers. Totally. So the amount of work that is, or the heavy lifting that's done by Expo and ES, all these things, it makes a lot of sense. Great. I think, yeah, that's for the pre-build command. Let's move on to the next one, which I'm excited to talk about. Bundlers. I see there's a lot of work going around, like Metro and Metro for Web and React Suspense. What's your thought about that?
We can talk about Metro a bit. So at Expo, I work on the bundling and the bundlers and the dev tools. And for those of you who don't know, Metro is the default bundler. So think of it like Webpack in a regular React app. But Metro is very specific to React Native. And I actually think that in time, we're going to see a lot more bundlers like Metro, where they are made very specifically by the framework tool for that specific framework, just because we want to, you know, move fast. We want to make things as refined as we can get them. So with Metro, it's been kind of like a one-size-fits-all project for a long time, and it's been kind of limited on functionality. But recently, we've actually been able to land a lot of great stuff. I've been working with the maintainer of Metro. This is a guy, Modi Zilberman, works at Meta, and he's been like fantastic to work with, super smart guy. And we've been able to just land a ton of new features and functionality. So with this new CLI, because it's versioned, we're able to do a lot more things that we just weren't able to do safely with the global CLI. So this is stuff like you mentioned, adding Metro web support, which we actually have a doc for in the Expo docs. And it's experimental right now, but it's coming along. And then suspense. So that's not like data loading, but specifically the React suspense syntax. So Metro has some variation of this built in for development mode. And what that does is, for instance, say you had a bunch of screens in your app, like 500 screens, and each one of them was loaded behind React suspense and the lazy imports. Then when the bundler goes to look at the code, it will stop bundling at each one of those suspense boundaries. So if your app scales up to be really big, we're able to effectively start up the bundler and bundle your app super quickly because of all these suspense boundaries. So this is a function feature that we are adding to Expo right now. We have kind of a working proof of concept, but we want to develop it out a bit more in web before we roll it out and see if we can also get it working in production.
Yeah. It's really interesting that we are taking Metro and taking it to the web. I've seen people do the other way around. Like, I've seen people bring Webpack to React Native. I think there was an experimental project by Callstack called Hall Bundler or something like that.
Yeah, it's called Repack now.
Yeah, it's called Repack. Okay. I'm curious if you had a chance to look at that and taking Webpack to React Native versus taking Metro to the web, which one is more appropriate and why? I would love to understand that if you have any thoughts there.
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts on it. I know it's a bit controversial. And I looked at, I feel like I've been the most avid, just outspoken against Metro for so long. And I looked at bringing Webpack to native for a while. Some of the issues is just that Webpack doesn't have this like structure for multiple apps at the same time. So when you start to load up like an iOS and Android and a web app, it starts to get pretty slow. It also just has various memory issues, and Webpack is great because it's super customizable, but that's also something which is kind of a drawback of it. So what's nice about Metro is that it's very simple. It's got this three-part system where it resolves files, it transforms them, and at the very end, it serializes them, effectively the bundling process. It takes these chunks and it adds them together. And because this process is so simple, you're able to just really squeeze out a lot of speed and performance. And we're seeing that with Metro on web. It's really fast. And I actually think we're going to see a lot more bundlers which do this type of like caching, memoization, whatever you want to call it, where you just like while you're doing the development cycles, the reload is just super fast. And Metro is probably the best bundler when it comes to caching. Like it has the most aggressive caching, which can sometimes be not great, but they've actually worked out a lot of the bugs with that, and now it's really nice. And it can actually cache even crazier. Some stuff we might investigate is that you can have these kind of shared caches across your team, which is what Meta does internally to effectively make their apps start up really fast. Is they have a CI job which like bundles the project, creates the Metro cache, and then when they pull it, they're able to pull that cache with them. So Metro is really, really nicely suited for projects at scale, like very large applications. And what we need to do now is just kind of figure out how to make it work nicely on that initial startup and make it work really nicely in some of the smaller cases. But as your project scales, Metro is just like a really solid choice.
That's actually a bit surprising, to be honest, for me to hear all that. Because in the past, I've heard people talking about Metro and how it is so different than their experience with Webpack and how it made debugging a bit of pain at one point. I think I'm not really sure, but there was a coupling with Flow and a few other things that is very internal to Meta. And I'm not really sure what happened to that. Like, do we still have a lot of like Meta specific things in Metro right now?
Yeah, so something that is Meta specific to a lot of tools produced by Meta is that internally a lot of Meta tooling just doesn't use node modules. They have a lot of, you know, just folders. And because of this, when you use Meta's tooling, this is like React Native, Flow, Metro, in a regular project outside of Meta where you have node modules, you start to see some of the issues. So one example of this is like in like Next.js's bundler and Vite, they don't actually target the node modules for transpilation. They usually just target the source code that you're writing. So maybe your app.js gets transpiled with Babel, and then everything else gets transpiled very minimally or not at all, and just gets linked to your project. Whereas Metro doesn't really have this concept built into it. So it will transpile everything with the most expensive Babel preset possible. Now, obviously, this is very straightforward to fix. All you have to do is say, this folder right here is the node modules, don't transpile that, which is what we do with this project that we released called Expo Exotic Mode, which is just a custom version of the Metro config, and it bundles like 2 times faster than the default Metro. And we're just going to continue to do things like that. But yeah, you do see some of those issues kind of leak out into the open space, and then they don't make sense. This was a lot more prevalent with the whole Flow versus TypeScript issue.
Yeah, right. Okay. Makes a lot of sense. So since like you have like real strong opinions for Metro because it's very simple and fast, do you see that adoption coming to a lot more project? Like, do you see that as a something that stands by the side of, say, Vite or Webpack and all these famous bundlers, and the adoption coming to, say, CRA or Next.js?
I think probably, like I said, a lot of these frameworks are going to just roll their own custom implementation, and they're just going to lean very heavily into that. So you see this with Vite especially, but I think you're going to see a lot more tools which just have their own bundler specifically. And so React Native already has that with Metro. So I don't know about like the whole widespread adoption. I imagine within React Native, everyone will continue to stick with Metro. Like right now, almost every React Native project uses Metro, right? It's almost every React Native web project does not use Metro. So I imagine we'll be able to shift that to where pretty much every platform you're targeting with React Native will be using Metro. Metro's also, yeah, it's just got really like good potential to be pretty quick and pretty fast. You can do things like it spawns up all of these threads to run Babel. You could just spawn those up in a different language if you wanted to. So for instance, you could spawn it up and run, do all the transpilation in ES build. We actually have a minifier that works with ES Build right now, and it's super fast. So if you want to switch out, currently uses Uglify, which is one of the slowest. And yeah, there's just many ways to make it pretty quick. What's really nice, like I said, about Metro is that it's very simple. So for instance, someone mentioned to me recently that like, how are we going to do things like the ESLint plugin in Webpack? How are we going to implement that in Babel or in Metro? And the answer is we probably won't, because like you could just run ESLint before you bundle, and if there's errors, you just stop. Whereas Webpack, it just implements these functions. It's more of like an entire build pipeline rather than just the bundler. Whereas Metro is very specifically just the bundler, and you can use it just like that. So if there's, you know, like if in Webpack, maybe you have an index.html generator plugin. In Metro, you can just run the bundle, you get the list of bundles, and then you just, you know, create an index.html as a string after you run Metro. So there is, I guess, room for build pipeline tooling around Metro, but that simplicity is what's really nice. And it's also what makes it kind of hard to compare it to other bundlers.
Yeah, I think that's the problem with other bundlers, because they are trying to do more than just bundling. And this is the whole build pipeline, right? I think, and that's where, I mean, if you look at Webpack, it's known that like setting up Webpack in a fresh project, right? And how difficult all those
very difficult
can be. But yeah, makes a lot of sense, and I really like the web support and everything that's coming along with Metro.
Yeah, it's super nice to develop new features in, actually.
Yeah.
Like we just released require.context support, which is this new feature that'll be coming to React Native, and you can use it to import entire directories, which is good for things like Storybook. Currently, what you do with React Native Storybook is you run this script, which generates, but with this, you'll be able to just create files and then your app will fast refresh, and then it will have those files right in the app. So you're able to basically auto import things. And we're going to use this for our new auto routing system that we're building at Expo. It's like the largest external contribution to Metro, I think, ever. So super, super great work with the team on that one. But yeah, that it's just like really fast inside of Metro. And we were able to develop the entire feature from Metro Web, which is way, way nicer than developing it in Metro for iOS or Android, because the web runtime has console logs. You can check network requests. You can profile things, set breakpoints. And then there's like, it's almost impossible to make a native crash in the browser. And if you do, then, you know, Chrome will fix it right away. So something that's really nice about Metro Web is that we're seeing the velocity of feature development just kind of skyrocket compared to what it was doing.
That's interesting, like how you can import all the files. And is that the thing that you're using with the Next.js sort of API that's coming up? I mean, I'm very interested and curious to know more about that, because what if we could do something like Next.js and then ship it for all the platforms? Because now it's web and then file-based routing, then that gets to something like Next.js.
Yeah. So file-based routing will probably, I mean, there's still a lot of work to do on file-based routing. I'm working on that project right now. The first step was creating required context so that Metro could be aware of more files. But the idea is currently that the DX will be very similar on native to what it will be like on web, but most of the value you'll find on web, and you will find maybe less value on native, at least in production. On native, you'll get a lot of value in development. So for instance, every file system based entry point we could lazily load. So it means your bundler would start up super fast, that thing I was talking about with React Suspense. And it would be much easier to just create a bunch of files and then create some, you know, nice default navigation system and switch around between navigation paradigms. But the big thing is that your code will all be laid out in such a way where on web we'll be able to do things like just modern development patterns. So we'll be able to maybe render pages as SSR, tree shake things, bundle split on page boundaries. So a lot of the benefit here is effectively, like, currently it's really hard to share navigation code on native and web, and it's hard to get that structure right. So we're creating a system where you're able to get that just best possible web experience, but then also it doesn't hinder your native development at all. And in some ways, it will improve your native development.
Makes a lot of sense, because I am personally interested into something like this a lot, because I have been into like sharing code between like web and mobile. And if you look at, we already had a discussion on using native base and how we are trying to like share code between all the platforms. So if this happens, we are using Solito for that right now to share the routing on web and mobile phones, right? But if something official comes out from Expo, and I think that would be a huge adoption by the community, and people would just straight away jump and use Expo Universal, if you call it that. And yeah, that'll solve a lot of problems. If you go an extra mile and then have SSR, SSG and whatnot, I think that makes a lot of sense, and that'll add a lot of value.
Yeah, well, it's that's what we're hoping for. And yeah, I think that the first step is to just unblock SSR and SSG, right? Like, you write your code in a way where we're not blocking it. Currently, in a React Native web app, the main way you write your code is like an SPA or a single page application. And that's pretty blocking for attempting to implement SSR and SSG. So we want to restructure that, where the way you write your app is like an SSR and SSG app. And even if we don't have it right away, then we can implement those features in potentially Metro, and you'll be able to output and do all this. And after we get a lot of that done, Metro should scale up quite nicely, because it's well suited for a lot of these tasks in ways that Webpack isn't. So a lot of the like CI benefits that I was talking about, and the caching benefits, you could share cached fragments while you're attempting to generate like SSR chunks or SSG chunks, just making things like really fast to rebuild and ship to production. But in order to do that, we need suspense, we need require context, we need Metro for web, we need the local CLI. So a lot of these things are coming along, but there's still a bunch of things kind of blocking. But this is like the ultimate goal, is to have this nice universal navigation system.
Yeah. When do you think we will be in a state so that it can be adopted in production applications? Do you think like another 6 months we'll be there and we'll be able to use it?
I don't know. It's a very difficult project.
Okay.
We're going through a couple iterations right now. So I have two or three different approaches.
Mm-hmm.
One is very React navigation heavy, and the other is it's a bit more web focused. So it's similar to kind of like what Remix does, where you have an outlet, but that outlet is a lot more advanced, so it can handle things like animations. Because on web, with things like nested routes, that's just like one, it's like one component. And when you change the route, you can switch out what that component is, and you can like just pull it in. On native, that's almost never the case, because you're switching between multiple different views. So you have these kind of like, for instance, if you have a view pager for your tab bar, or if you have like just a basic stack navigator, you kind of need to have reference to both like two or three components at the same time. So potentially maybe the existence of a route generates this kind of shell view, which handles all the animation and gestures. And then inside of each one of the like little slots, we can load in a server component from each screen. So that's a different approach that we're looking at. Very complicated. It's kind of like if you think of like the top of the line web experience right now with things like nested routes. Imagine that, but then complete, and then imagine like animated routes, and just like this kind of like universal animated route system, where we also have opinions about how navigation elements should look. So that's things like powerful tab bars, where you can do things like double tap them to go to the top of the screen, or long press them to open some action on native, and then on web, just switching it out so it's a bunch of anchor elements.
Right.
So there's a lot of things to consider and do here. So it's hard to predict. I imagine the first version will come out and it will be pretty rough, and then we'll just keep iterating on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. This somewhat reminds me of our conversation about Flutter, because Flutter is also trying to solve the same thing, like one code for all the platforms, and they are also struggling the same way.
I don't know if it's the same way, but they are struggling.
They are struggling for sure, because Flutter Web is not up to the mark yet. Whenever I speak to Flutter developers, they say it's great on mobile phones, but it's not that great on web.
Flutter is great on Android. It's not very good on iOS, and it's really bad on web.
Yeah, right.
Like, it's a canvas, so it's, I wouldn't even call it not up to the mark. It's, there's like no semantic HTML. They have to worry about SEO before they can even worry about server components.
Yeah, yeah. I think then React Native Web and React Native plus the Expo and all these things, they have like a really good stand when we talk about like sharing code between all the platforms. Right now it's like much better.
React Native is definitely a better way to create proper native apps. You know, Flutter is much nicer cross-platform, but if you want a cross-platform app that isn't truly native, then, you know, like you could use Cordova or something where you've got CSS and then it properly runs on web because it could just be server rendered. So I'm still trying to figure out where Flutter really fits in that market. They're doing a great job marketing it to people.
I wouldn't carry forward this conversation. I think this is more of a private thing we should talk. But yeah, good to know your views on this, Evan. Great. Yeah, I think this is all good. I had a few more questions, but I'm not sure whether we should take it public because this is more of the model that Expo is heading towards. Like now we are building a lot of web and universal sort of thing, and then it's heading into its own framework of a web and mobile. Does it look like the future of Expo is more like something what Vercel is doing, or is it going to be a different model? Yeah, you're okay. If you don't want to answer this question, that's fine. But if you want to take it, go ahead.
Yeah, so the kind of model we're looking at, well, like first and foremost, what we're trying to do at Expo is just solve this native development problem. So like native development, it's just hard, right? Like building apps is too difficult. And we still have a lot of things that we can work on in this area. Like for instance, it's hard to kick off a build from anything other than your actual computer. Like what if you could just kick off the build from like, you know, from Git, like from GitHub or the web or something, that would, you know, be much nicer. What if the builds were substantially faster? Currently they're, you know, a lot slower than if you were to start up just a web thing because, well, I guess the JavaScript part is about the same, but the having to like create the native part is actually faster than the web because building Chromium from scratch takes a while. But we could maybe make it super fast. So we want to, you know, just like focus on really solving these issues and just make native this really seamless and really nice experience. Cause we see a lot of people just switching over to spending the majority of their day on mobile and native apps. And we're not seeing the native development experience really catch up to meet that. So we want to help like deliver in that area. And we also want to help make distribution really, really nice. So I see Cedric's here. Cedric's on my team. He's working on this thing called EAS metadata, which we're going to be kind of writing about more formally in the next week or two. But EAS metadata is out right now. I highly recommend people check it out. Super cool. What it does is it lets you manage and maintain all of your App Store metadata and presence locally from a JS or a JSON file. So it means you can do automation, generate things, you can check them. So for instance, you could have your app in review, and I actually just moved all my stuff over to EAS metadata, super nice. But say you have an app in review and you have some very benign issue, like maybe your app is using version number 0.0.0. Apple will reject that because it implies beta functionality. And it'll take them like 24 hours plus to send you that rejection, just so you can like change one value and resubmit a binary. So with EAS metadata, what we're able to do is build a lot of this like these known rules in and just warn you instantly in like milliseconds that you have some sort of thing which will cause a rejection. So that project's coming along really nicely, but there's just so many things like that's just for iOS, and we'll, you know, look at adding Android support in the future. So we have a ton of things to solve on the native front, but we do want to really unblock web and help people kind of fast forward in front of us. So before we have like really nice, solid, you know, first-class solutions for web. We want people to be able to build out and not be blocked by any of the tooling that we're building here. So that's some of our goal. We call it kind of the fast-forward principle at Expo, and we try to do that a lot with things like pre-build, where we like to build config plugins that help people, but if we don't have those yet, we want people to be able to just hop out, develop the plugin themselves, and continue going before we have time to get to it. So that's kind of like the direction we're going in right now. For the model, you know, we have all these great cloud services, and we just want to, you know, deliver that really, really solid developer experience that web developers have had for years to native developers. And I think we're getting like pretty close, but there's still some work to do.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I really like the vision of Expo, and I'm pretty much aligned. I mean, I share the same vision of like improving the DX for mobile and web, and maybe universal as well, and then help them to quickly go to the market and all those services that Expo is doing. So pretty impressed and quite ambitious too. I want to wish all the best to you and the Expo team. Great. Any final thoughts, Evan? Hot takes.
Yeah. So I could plug. I'll plug some things. I've done enough hot takes. So I think check out EAS metadata. It's pretty sweet. It cuts out a lot of just kind of annoying issues. We are working with Aman Mattel, who I see is here actually listening right now. He's working on improving our entire like docs experience. It's not an easy task. We do, you know, native is just very difficult and we cover a lot of things. He's doing incredible on it. He's also just a great writer. So I highly recommend checking out his stuff. If you're enjoying Expo, starring the repo on GitHub would help a lot to kind of, I guess, help people see that it's a big project. People care about this a lot, so I've got to care about it now too.
I think, Aman's work is seen everywhere. So, great work, great stuff, Aman.
We're super lucky to work with him.
Yeah, I see David, I see Cedric. I see a few people from my team too. So Rohit, Cyrus, Minu, hello all of you.
Yeah, it's a great crowd in here.
Great. All right, thank you so much, Evan, for your time. And we'll talk again. And I'm pretty sure that our paths are going to cross again because we are working on so many similar things. Let's work together and build this.
Yeah, excited to see what you do next.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, everyone. Bye-bye.